Tonight on Arena, Tara Brady is live from the 81st Venice Film Festival and new albums from Mercury, Rev, David Gilmour and Fred Again up for review. Is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. This year's Venice Film Festival has certainly delivered in spades on glamour and gossip as ever. It fires the starting gun for next year's Oscar race with chatter around performances from leading ladies, including Angelina Jolie, Tilda Swinton and Julianne Moore. But the 81st Venice Film Festival has also sparked chatter about the length of feature films. Case in point here is The Brutalist, starring Adrian Brody, and clocking in at a whopping 3 hours and 35 minutes. Its length isn't the only extraordinary thing about it, by all accounts. More on that presently, as we're joined from the Venice Lido by Tara Brady. Let's start, in fact, Tara, with that film, The Brutalist, which has garnered so much attention. I suppose we should say there is an intermission of 20 minutes, and the 3 hours 35, I think, includes that 20 minutes, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does. It actually has it baked in, and you can see a countdown, you know, as if you were watching one of those sort of streamed theatre performances where there's like a countdown clock attached. But I'll tell you what, I did not notice the length for a second. It's just so gripping from the get-go. There's this extraordinary opening sequence where you find out later that Adrian Brody's, who's the central character, he's an architect, he's survived the concentration camps, and he's staggering around in the darkness. And it's just this really, really nervy, and you realise that he's on a boat and he's about to stagger out into the light of Ellis Island, and it's just it's an extraordinary moment. And the whole film is built on moments like that, where you kind of feel yourself gasping in your chair.
So, in fairness, then it sounds as if you might need the 20-minute intermission because it's such an intense watching experience. Brad Corbett, the director here, a lot of praise heading that way.
Yeah, no, well, Brady Corbett has always been this kind of big, he's got two previous films. The first one won a major prize here at Venice for Which Childhood of a Leader, which again was about, you know, it was about the birth of fascism, and it had these two big parts, and they were both like extraordinary things, and there was really great performances from Robert Pattinson. And then we had Vox Lux, which again was a film that was about a lot of stuff. It starts with school shootings and moves to this Lady Gaga style pop star played by Natalie Portman, and it has an awful lot to say about America, and this has a lot to say about the birth of it. But again, it just plays like, you know, a kind of a hero story, but there's so much stuff in the margins. There's stuff about Zionism, the birth of Israel, the impact of European Jews coming in that post-war period, and what they meant to America and how they built America and what they contributed to it, and the fact that they're never quite really assimilated in the same way that other nations are. And then at the same time, it's the story about this architect who does not want to compromise. And he has this one patron who's this very classical wealthy wasp kind of character who's just brilliantly played by Guy Pearce. He's like completely kind of chilling character. And the word, you know, you don't even mind so much when he's shouting at you. Like, it's when he's trying to be nice or polite.
More
that's
frightening.
When he really comes across as completely evil.
Well, that certainly sounds like one to watch. And let me give Brady Corbett his why for some reason I dropped it earlier on. Brady Corbett, the director, Felicity Jones and Joe Alwyn also among the performances there, Adrian Brody, and as you were mentioning, Tara, Guy Pearce. Another performance I think that has really caught your eye and your imagination is Nicole Kidman. She's back on the Lido, this time with Antonio Banderas, and a hot young actor of the moment, Harris Dickinson. This is a film called Baby Girl. What's it about?
So Baby Girl is a really hot ticket because it's by Helena Wren, who's the young Dutch director who did Bodies, 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 which was a really kind of cult A24 horror in the last couple of years. Nicole Kidman, if you remember about more than 10 years ago, everyone was talking about how brave she was doing Naked weird kinky scenes in The Paperboy with Zac Efron. Well, she's doing it again, 10 years on, and not a bother on her. This is kind of an outrageously camp, purposely camp kind of dramedy. She's this kind of having it all character. She's a high-powered CEO of this kind of Amazon-alike company. She has this perfect, sexy marriage to Antonio Banderas, because, you know, he's Antonio Banderas. And, you know, she packs the lunches for your kids. And there's this fantastic scene where she fishes a dead skunk out of the pool at the family's country retreat. And she does it in this kind of fantastic gesture. And suddenly this young intern comes along and completely rocks her world. He's played by Harris Dickinson. And they end up in this kind of strange power game. It's not quite a conventional, well, insofar as BDSM is conventional, it's not that. It's some kind of weird control game. But I know I had an absolute ball watching it.
Right.
Like, you know, it's the kind of film that has, you know, George Michael's father figure and Mozart's Requiem as its music cues. It's going for broke all the way.
Well, let's listen to Nicole Kidman speaking at one of the press conferences about the film, and she's touching on the nakedness aspect that you spoke about there, Tara. But she's talking also about her own process and how she goes about playing these characters, making these films.
I mean, the thing is, I approach everything artistically, so I don't think of the minutiae. I just go, how do I give over to this particular character at this time fully, without censoring my director? And that's why it is important to feel safe with them, because I will just complete abandon to the story, to the nature of the character that I'm playing. So I don't think about bodies per se. I just think about, how do we tell the story, and what is your vision for it, and how do I help you, and how do we get there? And then we have big conversations, obviously, about the psychology of the character, all of those things. But what I'm bringing is just myself with openness and availability. And I've always done that with directors, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. But it's, I don't know any other way. I couldn't go into the environment protecting myself and being worried. I have to just go, okay, what do you want to do here?
That's Nicole Kidman speaking about the film Baby Girl and what she has to do within it. But interesting to hear how she approaches things. We have Tara Brady with us this evening, reporting from the Venice Film Festival. Luca Guadagnino, not a big surprise that he might like and enjoy Venice. And this year he brings a film called Queer, starring Daniel Craig. A lot of expectation around this, I believe, Tara.
Yeah, I think especially because it's him going, you know, he's returning to something like Call Me by My Name, Your Name, which is just so fantastic and has such a huge cult following, of course, in Ireland. And this is this kind of, it was a kind of lost novel manuscript for many years by William S. Burroughs. Most of Burroughs' work tends to be about William S. Burroughs. So there's a Burroughs surrogate called Lee. He's in 1940s Mexico City, and he's, you know, stylishly dressed, you know, wealthy, wandering around the city's clubs, and he becomes infatuated with Allerton, who's a young American Navy serviceman who's recently been discharged, played by Drew Starkey. So most of the film is them, you know, for 90 minutes. I think they have sex once and they smoke cigarettes. There are lots of really cool people who are parachuted in for supporting roles. Omar Apollo, David Lowery, the director, in a rare act role, and also Jason Schwartzman controversially in a fat suit. There's a lot of surreal interludes as well.
It does strike me, though, that you're saying that Daniel Craig plays this character of Lee, who's a kind of a William S. Burroughs surrogate. He's not obvious casting, one would have to say, for a character like that, is he?
No, not at all. And I think he's very miscast. I can see the thinking. It's like, oh, wow, what if, James Bond is doing these explicit gay sex scenes? And I can see that why that might be a kind of marketing tool. But he's totally the wrong body type. I mean, when you picture William S. Burroughs, you picture, Max Schreck from Nosferatu. He's this spindly kind of in the big long coat. And Daniel Craig is not that. And I also feel that he's channeling a little bit of the Knives Out character, and that he's just you feel like he's doing a bit, he's doing an accent, and because you're looking at Daniel Craig doing a bit in all these nice clothes and places that look like magazine shoots, you never really get into the movie. And that's kind of double down on that there's not a lot of content. Now they do go off on one adventure into the jungle, and they meet a wild, a kind of feral Leslie Manville, who's a botanist who's gone native. And that livens the movie up no end.
All right, Pedro Almodovar is there with his first English language feature, The Room Next Door. This stars Tilda Swinton and Julianne Moore. Pablo Larraín has made a film about Maria Callas, with Angelina Jolie as the great opera singer. I believe there's a lot of acting awards buzz around both of these films. I think you've seen The Room Next Door, haven't you?
Yes, I've seen The Room Next Door. It's a funny one because it's about two old friends. They haven't seen each other in ages. And Julianne Moore comes to visit Tilda Swinton's character when she finds out that she has a terminal cancer diagnosis. And they immediately spark the friendship back into life, and they become indispensable to each other, especially when one asks for assistance with euthanasia. But most of it is mostly a two-hander. They're talking in sort of big, long, pieces of dialogue, and there's an awful lot of references to James Joyce's The Dead, both the book and the movie, and the end of the movie, and you do feel as an Irish person sitting there going, you can't have that. That's ours.
Give it back.
I think it's not as good on those themes as Antonio Banderas was in Pain and Glory.
And Angelina Jolie as Maria Callas. And of course, Brad Pitt, the ex-husband. Are they ever going to be allowed to be separate from each other? He arrives with his new film, Wolves, along with co-star George Clooney. But what I wanted to speak about as we finish up, briefly, first of all, Tara, some terrific television, TV projects as part of the film festival. How unusual is it to have TV within a film festival like this? I know it's something that has started to creep in recent times.
It's not unheard of, but certainly there's a lot of big name directors, and they're coming along and they're showing sort of shows in two parts or the first four episodes of a particular series. I think that's definitely more prominent, and there's definitely more of them this year. Partly it's due to timing, partly it's to kind of plug holes that might be left over from last year's actors' strike, of course, as well.
Give me one TV highlight from what you've seen or what you've been hearing about.
I love families like ours, which is the Vinterberg one in which Denmark is evacuated. But my favourite was definitely the Mussolini one from Joe Wright, the director of Pride and Prejudice and Atonement. And it's a fantastic performance by Luca Marinelli, who's obviously a kind of very classic looking movie star. He's completely unrecognisable in this film. And it's completely puffed up, and you're kind of watching him. He's like a bomb, and you think he's going to go off, and he's incredibly violent. But once you get into it, it's very, very, it's very thrilling.
Finally, Joaquin Phoenix was getting a bit of a grilling.
He certainly was, and the film has not got universal reviews. The film is Joker Folie à Deux. It's the musical follow-up to Joker, which obviously won't play well with all of the fan base of 2019, because there's bound to be a few fellas in there that wouldn't be caught dead at a musical with Lady Gaga. It's a jukebox musical, which it's very brave that Todd Phillips took the decision to make that, but it doesn't quite work. All of the musical numbers keep kind of taking you out of the film as opposed to kind of pushing the narrative along. I mean, Gaga sings her heart out, we know that, but it's a very underwritten character for her.
Let's listen to Joaquin Phoenix, however, not talking about this film in particular, but about the Todd Haynes film that he pulled out of, he withdrew his services. Here's a lesson in how to not answer a question.
Recently you dropped out of a Todd Haynes film shortly before shooting. Can you tell us what happened there and why did you depart that film?
I think if I do, I would just be sharing my opinion from my perspective, and the other creatives aren't here to say their piece, and it just doesn't feel like that would be right. I'm not sure how that would be helpful. So I don't think I will. Yeah. Thank you.
I thought he was just going to say, so no, I'm not going to say anything. So there he was, obviously commenting about the Todd Haynes film that, he pulled out of.
Yeah.
I think no is much easier and much better, much quicker. thanks for giving us all of that this evening, Tara. Enjoy the rest of the festival.
Ciao.
Ciao, Bella. That's Tara Brady, who joined us there from the glamorous surrounds of the Venice Film Festival. Next weekend, the County Wicklow Festival of Art and Nature, the Shaking Bog, hosts a wide range of artistic and nature-based events in Enniskerry, Bray and Glencree Valley. On Saturday, we are offered an evening of folk songs and storytelling with Mercury Prize-nominated English singer Sam Lee. Sam is a chronicler of the natural world through his four critically acclaimed albums. He's also the author of Singing with Nightingales, and I'm delighted that he joins me on the programme this evening ahead of his trip to Enniskerry. I love that kind of dual side to your life and your work, Sam, that the folk song collector and the connection to the natural world. I know you've said in the past that one of your aims in your work is to find new sound worlds for old songs. Talk to me a little bit about where you go looking for these old songs and where you find them.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here. And I will confess that much of my research and my practice started off over in Ireland. I spent about 15 years travelling all around, meeting with the Irish travellers and recording thousands of songs from the elders, many of whom have sadly passed on. And it was a real insight into the oral traditions, the rich culture that is still alive. And also that closeness that those songs have to a way of life that was very nature rich and very connected and aware and sensitive to nature, and felt that those songs needed to be learned, loved, recorded, documented, shared out to kind of mark that old way that we once had of being more engaged with the natural world.
And did you find much of a connection between the songs that you collected on this island and the songs that you collected on the island of Britain?
I mean, the repertoire is in many ways one of the same. There are lots of Irish songs, but lots of Irish songs that exist in England. There are lots of English songs that exist in Ireland. There's a rich exchange there. And that's because, you know, the songs travel with the people. And so many of the songs, like a wild seed, will take root in a new land and become naturalized. Songs are like a very organic in that way. But in many ways, the subjects within the songs were very similar, and particularly the appreciation, the love, adoration of nature was strong within the Irish songs, very much so.
Your most recent album, Song Dreaming, however, is an album of original songs, your own compositions. What sent you in that direction? What did you want to say through your own work, through your own compositions?
Well, it was an album written ultimately for a movie that came out last year called The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, beautiful English feature. And
Jim Broadbent was the Harold Fry character, I think, wasn't he?
That's right.
We spoke to him on the programme about the film, yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Well, the songs were written for the film, many of them made in. In fact, the song that ends the film is a beautiful Irish traveller song that I learned from Waterford, from the Connors family. And I took lots of folk songs, but I rewrote them and adapted to really speak about, in a more contemporary way, about what it means to be in relationship with nature in an age of climate catastrophe, in an age of reawakening, and in a time where we have such ecological knowledge that there's a whole new form of appreciation and nature protection and love and respect that we can have. And the way that folk songs maybe don't always articulate in that way I want to speak about. So I wanted to be more lyrical from my heart and from my perspective.
Let's listen to one of the songs on the album, the song Bushes and Briars, and interesting lyrics within this that pick up on your interest in the natural world, as we'll hear. Thank you.
through bushes and through briars. I've lately made my way, oh, for to hear a small bird sing. I make my peace that way, oh, for to hear that small bird sing. And heed what they've to say. Your speak is filled with woe betide, yet singly sublime. A language, a liturgy, alive yet saturnine. For your rarity determines mine. Such times we find we're in the presence of divine.
Opening section there of the song Bushes and Briars, and that comes from Sam Lee, who's speaking to me on the programme this evening ahead of his appearance at the Shaking Bog Festival. You get a sense of, you're really speaking directly to us, or the singer is singing directly to us there. And while some of these songs were used in the Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, I think for the purposes of the album, Sam, you kind of invented or thought of the songs as being sung by a wandering character rather than the Harold Fry character of the film.
Well, the beautiful thing about Pilgrimage and how that film kind of characterised the act of pilgrimage, not as a religious gesture, but as a permissive way of travelling the land, about awakening to landscape and the healing power of it as well. But that two-way thing, that both, it's such a powerful thing to be out on the land. I do a lot of pilgrimage making myself, and how that has helped me, keeps me sane, but also what a gesture, a reciprocal gesture of care that does for the land, to be out there in a place of adoration. Mm. And the film kind of painted that picture beautifully and allowed me to sort of dream and speak into that in a way that, you know, sometimes one needs their own permission to kind of be so open-hearted in one's art.
And you're singing in the midst of that. There are a couple of different themes that come up, but in the section we listened to there, you're talking about literally going through the bushes and briars and a small bird singing to you, which I think probably links in with your book, Singing with Nightingales.
Yeah, I mean, your listeners are going to think you've got a total nutcase here on your show, but I spend 8 weeks of my spring living in the woods in Sussex, south of England. And it's a landscape where they have a very small population of a very rare bird, which is the nightingale, this phenomenal singer, one of the greatest singers on the planet, and a bird that improvises with musicians. And I take audiences out and guest musicians. We've had lots of wonderful Irish musicians. Some of your legendary musicians have come out with their violins and whistles and played with the birds. The birds will improvise back with them, human musicians. And the part of that Bushes and Briars song speaks about every night when I'm in there in the darkness with about 50 people listening to this bird who's right in front of us. We're hearing this exquisite concert, but knowing this bird is going to go extinct from England within the next 20 years. I'm the last generation to hear this bird sing, and it'll die, it'll disappear in my lifetime. It's such a kind of complex, tragic and bittersweet, yet beautiful set of emotions. So that's what this song is speaking to.
Yeah, later in the song, in fact, there's a lyric where you say, or the singer sings, sometimes I think we've gone too far to turn it around in time. Now, that obviously links into what you've just been saying about the nightingale, but I'm guessing there are much bigger concerns within, you know, hiding within, or not hiding, in plain sight, hiding in plain sight within that line.
I mean, the nightingale, as I say, is the canary in the coal mine. What happens to nightingales happens to us. And, you know, not to be a doom monger, but, you know, that they are just a representation of a wider collapse. And so when I see this, like this this beautiful bird, this beautiful song going, I realize that it's connected to so much else we are destined to lose unless we change our ways.
Do you think, you know, when you say some things, sometimes I think we've gone too far to turn it around in time. Do you think there is still time?
Oh, indeed. We have all the answers. There's so much we could do, and the future could be so much more beautiful. The land more enriched with species, our diets healthier, our societies happier, more equal, more just. We just have to make better choices, really, and, you know, choose our leaders and our policies. So I'm a hopeful person. I'm an optimist, but my hope is about having a plan and fighting for it.
Yeah. Finally, Sam, I know that you will be performing in St. Patrick's Church in Enniskerry on the Saturday, but you are a man who likes, as you've just described, to take a bundle of people into the bushes and to listen to the bird song and other things. Have you plans to do a little bit of outdoor pilgrimaging and performing while here?
Well, for those who make it, I am running some little workshops where we're going to do some nature immersion. And this goes way beyond just singing a gig. This is the stuff I love doing. It's leading people into really like deep practice. And it's out there and it's eccentric, but I think the people who show up are going to love it. So yeah, I look forward to some of your listeners coming and joining me.
Indeed, and I'm sure they will enjoy themselves. Sam, lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Sean. Thank
you. That's Sam Lee and the Shaking Bog, where art and nature meet, will take place in the Glencree Valley on the 14th and 15th of September. That's the festival in general. Sam Lee will be performing at St. Patrick's Church in Enniskerry on Saturday the 14th at 8:30. Full information on shakingbog.ie. And we're on the final lap of the week. Friday evening, time for our album reviews. Three distinctly different, equally compelling artists, I think you will agree. Brand new releases. English producer, DJ and multi-instrumentalist Fred Gibson, also known as Fred Again, releases his fourth studio album. It's called 10 Days. Features a plethora of guest appearances, the likes of Sampha, Soak, Anderson, Pack, Fortet, Skrillex and Emmylou Harris is in there as well. We'll also be talking about Mercury Rev's Born Horses, which sees the band shifting perhaps into unexpected territory with some spoken word vocals, but still the atmospheric, dreamlike sound going into very intimate spaces, I would argue. And finally, Pink Floyd's David Gilmour gives us Look and Strange. This marks his return to classic rock roots, family collaborations, lyrical reflections on love and loss with, as always, amazing guitar playing. I mean, no matter what he does on a stringed instrument, it sounds amazing to my ears. With me in studio this evening, Aoife Barry and John Maher, been listening to all three albums. Let's start with Fred Again, in fact, and let's start with the opening track on that album. There you go. If that doesn't put a smile on your face on this fine summer's evening in the middle of September, I don't know what will. Adore You, the title of the track. Oban Joyer, the artist involved there in the Fred Again production. And as you quite rightly pointed out to me, John Maher, as we listened to it, that's actually the second track on the album, John. You are absolutely right. Track one is 30 seconds of them.
It is, and it's
noodling around in the studio.
It is worth pointing out that there are 20 tracks in this album.
Yeah.
But each alternate one is merely a fragment.
Yeah, it's kind of, it has that feeling of the album is called 10 Days, and it's almost as if I have 10 collaborations here, and on day one, we were in the studio, here's us nattering, and then here's the song. Mm. On day two, because track three is two. And so all the odd tracks are the day numbers and all the even tracks are the actual songs.
For sure, but I think it also, those fragmentary moments pull the album together, gives it a cohesiveness, because the danger when you've got so many collaborators, it's going to feel like the work of committee. I think that he manages to avoid that quite cleverly.
Yeah, it is a clever way of doing that, because it is one of the challenges, is Aoife, in a situation. He's a producer, so it's not about his music per se. He's kind of the production is the vehicle for the artists to
shine.
That's
it. It's like he's kind of like the painter. They are the paint, you know, and he's, you know, they're on the little palette and he's putting it all together. And he's someone who, you know, played a lot of instruments, learned a lot of instruments when he was younger. Fred, again, his real name is Fred Gibson. Well, he has a much longer name because he's from quite a posh background in the UK. He's got some interesting relatives, including Ian Fleming through marriage, who, of course, created James Bond. And he is someone who, you know, was kind of rubbing shoulders with the likes of Brian Eno when he was young, who was a neighbour, and he took part in an a cappella group that he had going in the neighbourhood. So he's someone who didn't just kind of fall off the street into a studio. Yeah. He's someone who had that kind of backing behind him and, I suppose, knows people who know people, but also was making music himself. And what's really interesting about him is he really emerged as a, you know, a record maker as opposed to a record producer, because he worked with people like, you know, Ed Sheeran and Charlie XCX himself during the pandemic. And I think that's really the key to Fred again, his connection with people, is that he was making music that in that was kind of reflecting how he was feeling, and literally was kind of themed almost like a diary in the titles of the songs and everything, like diaristic, and reflecting how people were feeling during the pandemic. Yeah. When we think about friends, thinking about going out, thinking about what we're missing, and he has that almost like future nostalgia, to steal Dua Lipa's term, around the world that he lives in and how he reflects that in music. And this album's a little bit different because the other albums were all under similar titles, and this album is feels like it's a next step for him. So it's a little bit different in terms of what he's reflecting on in the world that's around him, but he still has that fragmentary diaristic kind of approach to bits of it.
Some Irish input into this album as well, John.
Absolutely. Bridie Mons Watson, aka Soak, appears that, well she's written a number of tracks here, and there is a particularly beautiful song, I think called Just Stand There, where Soak's spoken worded observations about life and love, particularly those very early stages of love, are beautifully wrought. Interestingly, Gemma Doherty of Saint Sister is one of the co-writers on this album. Aoife mentioned the aristocratic background of Fred Gibson. He does have some Anglo-Irish relations as well, so
we can claim a bit of it.
And he did kind of soft launch this album in Dingle of all places last night.
That Soak track is absolutely beautiful. It is anybody. Because this is what I hear when I, who stood in the middle of a dance floor looking over at somebody on the far side of a dance floor, has had this feeling.
And I just stand there, going to the window, watching all the people go about their lives.
I could listen to it. And do they get together? Who knows? You have to buy the album and listen to the whole song to find that out. Other collaborators, and that for me is a real standout. I think for both of you too, that song is a real standout.
An absolute standout. Yeah, for
definitely.
Sure.
Emily Lou Harris is on there.
Yeah, so this was one of the tracks on the album that bothered me, because it's an amazing Emily Lou Harris track, and it's from her album Wrecking Ball, which came out in 1995. Where Will I Be? Which I think it was written by Daniel Lanois, who produced that record, and it was quite a big record for her in her back catalogue. And I think that might have been the year that Fred again was born, 95? Was he even born around then? I think he's 29. So I don't know if that's a reflection on his age or his life, but he pitches down the vocals in the song. And why would you pitch down the stunning vocals of Emmylou Harris?
Why would you touch them?
Why would you do that? I don't know. But in another way, it drew me back to that record, which I probably hadn't thought about in I don't know how long. And I remembered it coming out when I was a teenager. I wasn't listening to it at the time. So in one way, I was off listening to Emmylou Harris. I ordered the record and everything.
Yeah, maybe
so
that,
I mean, you know, he did his job maybe that way, but it's interesting. And he has people like Anderson .Paak, and he has Sampha Fortet as well, which is really interesting collaboration, because obviously he's kind of an older statesman in the kind of electronic music world in Britain, and then you have Skrillex, who is American and would have really brought out the kind of EDM movement in 2010. So it's interesting range of collaboration.
All right, I think you both enjoyed this album. Stars from you first of all, Aoife?
I probably enjoyed it slightly less than you did. I give it 3.5 stars because I felt like some of the songs for me didn't quite reach the peak of the promise that was held in the songs. And he is known for having a lot of kind of bangers, and there weren't a lot of bangers on this record. Sometimes it's a bit scattershot and a little bit frenetic for me, but when it's beautiful, it's really, really great.
It's good. It's very, very good.
Yeah.
I think this is very much a calling card for his prowess in the studio. You can see how good a producer he is. I think it clung together really well. I was very pleasantly surprised. 4 stars.
Four stars, okay. That is 10 days from Fred again. Let us move on now to album number two, Born Horses. Mercury Rev and Born Horses, new lineup here. American band's first album of new material since 2015. They're fond of big, long introductions here, and we have one of them playing as we speak. But after about 22 seconds on this very long introduction, there is the most stunning trumpet introduction.
My mood swings, and it swings, and it swings.
His mood swings, and it swings, and swings. But he doesn't get too bothered with his mood swings, certainly when he's speaking. Jonathan Donoghue there, obviously the singer, and for the most part of this album, the speaker.
Yeah.
It's how unusual and how big a shift is that,
Aoife
Barry?
It's a big shift for them. I think when you think of Mercury Rev, when I think of them, you think of him singing in that like higher register he has. He's such an unusual like nasal voice. And I remember hearing Deserter's songs, and I'm not someone who would have listened to them a huge amount over the years, but particularly really loved Deserter's songs when it came out in Goddess on a Highway, when I heard that breakout single by them from that breakout album, because they had a few albums up to that point. And I remember being about like 17 or something hearing, thinking, what is this? Like, it just was so arresting, so cinematic, so amazing, so atmospheric, and it just sounded like nothing else. And that's really what they do. Whenever you dip into their back catalogue, you're like, they're pulling from all these influences, but they're doing something completely unique and different. And they played in Dublin over the summer, and they were so loud as well when they play live. They're like the loudest band I've ever heard live. And this is so different for them to have this spoken word poetry. And he actually went to different parks. Well, I went to a park while they were recording the album, and Jonathan Donoghue, and recorded himself speaking into a really old Motorola phone or recorder, and then they brought back those recordings to the studio, polished them all up, and put them onto the record. So that's why they sound so kind of intimate. But I don't know about you, I wouldn't be so eloquent if I was sitting in a park just, you know, talking about, you know, what I was thinking. And
he might have written down a little bit of what he was going to say.
Maybe he's just a genius.
There is a sense though with Jonathan Donoghue that, you know, he lives in upstate New York in a rural part of the state. So much of his music is about the natural world, about animals and insects and his connection with it. And he is somebody who had his troubles. I mean, around the time of Deserter Songs, he had a heroin addiction, and he's cleaned up his life. And it seems like, unlike most rock stars, he lives a very peaceful, sedate life. And I think you can hear it here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's real beauty in the music. There's so much lovely texturizing going on in the arrangements. And it's quite a brave choice in a way to speak, sing like that.
Because, well, also to open the album with that track, Mood Swings, that we just listened to, which has 1 minute and 31 seconds before you hear any voice, and then it's the spoken word.
He obviously hasn't heard of Spotify and the notion of front loading everything, you know, 10 seconds to nab them before they switch. And I love that about this band, that there's, you know, it's almost like if you know, you know. It's you know, there's no attempt to kind of court daytime radio here, even though there are some beautiful moments.
And they said they were worried about it as well too in interviews. I was reading one in Uncut Magazine, and they were talking about they were really worried about what it could do to actually make this move. But I think their fans know, or anybody who's listened to them at any point knows, they're a band that like are really, they push things, you know. They're a psychedelic rock band, man, you know. They'll do whatever they want to do.
Let's listen to a track called Your Hammer, My Heart. There you go, Your Hammer, My Heart, and almost singing along the way there.
Yeah.
I did wonder about, you know, as cause the tracks separately, you can just imagine immersing yourself as a late night listen, I would argue. But when you're listening to the whole album, I thought, I wouldn't mind a wee bit of singing now anytime you're ready there, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, you might miss it, I think, particularly if you really love what he does vocally. And there probably is something to be said about, you know, you're talking about the late night vibe to it, where you probably aren't going to be on the bus necessarily listening to all of this record and not getting maybe a little bit antsy to maybe listen to something a bit more higher energy. But it's only 40 minutes long, and it's just a really beautiful piece. It's so cinematic. I just feel like when you listen to him singing, you just hear like there's like rain falling, somebody's in an apartment in New York or wherever, and that's just really, it's really evocative. I think
it's worth pointing out too, the day Dave Fridman, who has been with them for so long in the producer chair, does a remarkable job here of letting all these extraordinary instruments kind of have their space, and there is such a prettiness throughout. Yeah. And I think, you know, speaking is a challenging thing. I think he's got such an unusual voice and a distinctive voice that it sort of works.
Yeah. And one of the songs too, he talks about, he references the Irish sunshine fading away.
Yeah, very quickly, I think he says. He
hasn't been here. Well, he was actually here in the summer of 2024, but it might have been written in the previous summer, not this cold one.
No, yeah, definitely not.
Where did he find the Irish sunshine
that did fade away? Yeah, I don't know where they brought him on his trip here.
All right. Stars from you first on this one, John.
It's another very solid four. I think it's a really fine album.
Solid four from John. Aoife?
Yeah, exact same for me. Four stars.
Solid four for Born Horses and Mercury Rev. Final album this evening, Look and Strange. That's L-U-C-K and Strange, from David Gilmour. Little bit of a listen to the title track. Look and Strange, title track from the new David Gilmour album. And John Marr, Pink Floyd are alive and well.
Absolutely, not just that very distinctive guitar, but his voice
sounds
unchanged in half a century.
And the kind of the tinkly synthesizer keyboard is very 70s as well, isn't it?
It's almost like people talk about Dark Side of the Moon being such a pristine sounding album, and there's something of that quality here too. David Gilmour is 78 going, and he'll be 79 very soon, and there's a real sense here that he's looking back over his life in a way that's not particularly cliched. Like, I like the fact that there seems to be a lot of gratitude here. He acknowledges just what a great life he's had, and he was born into a sense, like he acknowledges his privilege, which is something that maybe some of his bandmates don't. Roger Waters, of course, being such a contentious figure at the moment, recently described by Gilmour as a crank.
The things that he's singing about here, I mean, it's all about love, it's about family, it's about, you know, really, he's looking, as John says, he's looking back and saying, wow, I kind of hit the jackpot here. And his daughter features on a couple of tracks.
His daughter, it's such a family affair. So they, the family recorded kind of live streams during the pandemic, and this seems to have kind of led on to a lot of the collaboration here. But he has collaborated many times before with his wife Polly Sampson, who is a novelist, and she writes, I think, most if not all of the lyrics here. And the lyrics for her really come from her thinking about, particularly during the pandemic period, thinking about losing him. She's a good bit younger than him, so I suppose she's worrying about that, about him being in his late 70s, and that idea of like not wanting that to happen and really feeling distressed at the thought of it. And I think so many people can empathise obviously with that, and so that's I suppose you get her reflecting back on life, but then you really feel like what John's talking about there, you feel like the sentiment is his too, because he is a man who's had a very long and interesting life, and they're both reflecting back on what they have. And then having his daughter Romany brings that sense of youth. She's only in her 20s, and she sings a cover of a song, Between Two Points, with her dad as well on it, so he's bringing them all in together.
I just want to listen to a little bit of A Single Spark. There you go. I mean, if ever there was a man contemplating his own mortality and celestial choirs that he's going to drift off into, that song does it.
It does. It does it really well. And it does it throughout the album, but in a non-cliched way. I mean, the interesting thing is this clocks in at over an hour, and yet it doesn't feel over long. There's lots of ideas happening here. I think the tracks with Romany are absolutely lovely. Her voice is quite beautiful. And particularly when she's singing about themes that are so relevant to her father, there's a kind of pathos there almost. I was really captivated by this.
The final track, you're saying it is over an hour long, but the final track is Lookin' Strange, original Barn Jam, which is this the track that we played earlier on, but it's a 14-minute version of it where they were clearly just noodling.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you've David Gilmour noodling on the guitar, it's probably going to be fine.
Can you imagine how often they're like, Dad, stop doing another guitar solo, for God's sake.
Maybe if you were hearing it every day.
We know you're romping.
Most of us.
We'll get Roger in if you're not careful.
Yeah.
Stars from you, John.
I sound like a broken record tonight, but it's another four for
me. And Aoife?
I'm going to go for three because there's only so much of that kind of classic 70s guitar solos I can listen to. Not as much as you can listen to, but maybe that's a failing on my part.
Okay, so three from you. That's Looking Strange from David Gilmour, Born Horses from Mercury Rev, 10 Days from Fred again, Aoife Barry and John Maher, our reviewers on this Friday evening. And that is our lot for tonight and indeed for this week. Liam Murphy researched, Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, James Feeney was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I will speak with you 7 o'clock Monday night once again here on RT Radio 1, and Ray Cudahy will be with you after the news.